key way to get to change people's behaviors on, in aggregate. The question then becomes, you know, what if we put a carbon tax on? Whether that's just tax or how that money is distributed or used is the second question, but just the carbon tax, I think that's a step in the right direction, but I'm not a huge fan of it, because what we're measuring there is we're measuring the final throughput effluent of the energy use. And so what you're counting on is that by taxing this, that all the right decisions are going to somehow filter up the line. And I would suggest that we would do much better to put our taxes or our influence or our policies on the front end, so we could fashion that and make sure that that energy actually, you know, with a carbon tax, it still might be that all the rich people with yachts burn it all up, and that might not be exactly what we want to do with that energy. You know, on the front end, we might be able to say, for example, imagine if there was a way to say, well, energy costs this much if you're going to do these sorts of things with it, but it costs this much if you want to do these sorts of things, and that much if you want to do that with it, right? Then you can start to more elegantly start to push things into different areas from the front of the story. So maybe we have a part of the stories at the back end, and that gives us a starting point, but I submit we're really going to have to be more clever at the front end. Because if I'm right and we're shrinking our surplus, where we use that becomes critically important. You know, whether we use that frivolously or we use that to really develop the next generation of alternative technologies is a fundamentally different sort of a proposition.
It's when you say front end, you mean sort of upstream at the wellhead?
Before it's burnt, yeah. Before it's used.
That was going to be my question as well. What do you mean by the front end?
Right. Yeah. But there is two separate ways to do it, and I'm not averse to any steps that might get us at least thinking about our energy use slightly differently at this point. I think that would be good as well.
And the other question, if we've got some sort of cap on demand for the sort of energy and environment side, is that sort of made useless? But if we don't deal with the economic side as well, as you say, the sort of squeezing the balloon problem.
Well, yeah. So the problem I see it is that our economic system, which really is fun. We think about it, we can actually look at it as just a mountain of debt. I mean, that's how we organize ourselves, is through debts. When banks have an asset, you know what that is? It's a debt, right? So when we look at the debts, I can't find a way that we're going to be able to service all of those debts out of a diminishing energy stream. Because really, let's talk about wealth for a second. Primary source of wealth would be rich soils, you know, concentrated ores, oil in the ground. It's what the earth gave us. And then humans take that and convert it into secondary wealth. So we farm the soil into food, and we take the iron ore and turn it into steel, and we take the oil out of the ground and turn it into gasoline. Tertiary wealth, then, is all this funny stuff we do on top of those primary sources of wealth and secondary sources of wealth. So that's all the stuff we've been talking about, which mostly is where our debt lives. It lives in this third band, but it's important to understand that it only has value if secondary and primary sources are there feeding it, because that's where it all starts, right? And I don't see a way that we can actually pinch the secondary part down and have this other part continue without somehow, some way, finding a way to shrink that in accordance with this. Now, the question is, how does that happen? Is it a jubilee? Do we just let the market deal with it and, you know, some win, some lose? It's a very difficult, thorny question. But it's not possible, you know, I would submit, to squeeze this and have this be unaffected.
Yeah. So you're really coming back to your new paradigm that everything needs to change quite dramatically. Yes. Yes, I think it's there. And no, there was one other person. Yes, and then there. Yeah.
Mike Jones, Transition Australia. would an economic climate do the best now right now? That's my first question.
That's got a more difficult one.
In other words, was the bailout the worst thing that could have happened? And second, just a sort of clarification point, really, in terms of the debt model of different countries, and Spain are being talked about in the Eurozone as one of the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. There's been countries that are likely to default. And yet your graph shows they're only at 250% versus other countries at 500% and beyond. So I don't understand why Spain are being talked about in the same context as Greece.
Right. That was just official debt. The total country debt is what you really care about. So when you think about it, you know, in my country, we have a federal debt, which is about $14 trillion or so, you know, it's approaching that when it hits its next ceiling this October. That's just one portion. Then we have our entitlements, that's another 50, 60 trillion. And then we have all the corporate debt. And you can say, well, that really belongs to corporations, but who works for corporations? Ultimately, all the debts within a border belong to the people inside that border. So the real question is, what's the total debt load of the country, not just the official or some other subsection? You get a much crisper focus when you don't fall for the whole thing. Well, look, we only have this much of this type of debt. You know, what you really want to do is look at all of it. And on that basis, those graphs change quite a bit. So that would be part one. Should we have an economic collapse? No, we really shouldn't. I really wouldn't want to see that at all. The thing is that, you know, this is a very deep subject, and I could go on and on about it. But the ways in which we, and by we, I'm talking the whole Western world at this point, approach this crisis, I believe, fundamentally made the problem worse, not better. In the sense that the imbalances are now larger than before we started, and I think that the moral hazard has been enforced and hasn't really punished appropriately the people who were at the core of this whole thing. So by way of example, you know, Citigroup got bailed out by my government on a Saturday morning to the tune of $300 billion. And the bondholders of that company took no losses. And what should have happened, the $300 billion is about how much they had in debt. So if we had just wiped out the bondholders and said, do your due diligence next time, you know, invest in a company that isn't bad like this and does bad things with your money, I think we could have not had any public money put into play. But even better, the people who were most core responsible for this would have gotten a message which said, we're not going to bail you out in the future. The lesson that was taken away from this is quite clear. If you're going to fail, fail big. Make sure that if you are going to fail, make sure you're too big to fail. So, and those lessons, believe me, got taken off. This crisis started in 1998 with long-term capital management. It was the original hedge fund crisis. They got bailed out in a way that everybody on Wall Street took a look at it and said, oh, I see how that's done. Right, that was the original mistake, and we compounded that over the next 10 years, and by the time this one blew up, they all knew how the game worked at that stage. And so we still have that game in play, that, you know, there is right now, the incentive is still to take as much risk as you possibly can. And I think that's going to end badly again. So I don't know if we should have one, but I think we haven't made it.
There's quite a queue. Okay. Yes, there. Then Ur, then at the front. Okay, yes.
Hi, my name is Suresh Mitra. I'm a software developer. I'm interested, I took the crash course a couple of years ago and it's good. I think data set, I think got kids as well, so I'm interested. But my question is, you talked about raising awareness, Chris, and what do you think about the notion that there are vested interests blocking raising awareness because, for example, the money is debt situation didn't come about by accident. It's actually a very lucrative way of fleecing the public through inflation. And so there are lots of interests that don't want to raise awareness. And it's difficult to get the message out there. If you talk about money as debt to the public, their eyes will glaze over, they won't have a clue what you're talking about. So I think there are vested interests blocking awareness.
Can I just add a joiner to that?
Yeah, sure.
You might incorporate vested interests, if you could map them, for the issue we're talking about, would fill 99.9% of the graphs. And the 0.1% would represent this thing that we call the meme of increasing awareness.
Mm-hmm.
That's the size of the struggle in terms of new paradigm development and comprehensive, systematic reconstruction of what purpose life is about and what purpose economics and environment generally have. So it's, you know, we talk about resistance as being a roughly equal kind of thing. We talk about awareness. In 743, the peasants in Basra revolted. And a book was written, Fables of the Animals. And it tells us your story. It talks about the despoilation of the environment, destruction of well-being, loss of moral purpose, and all that stuff. That's 1,200 years ago. None of that has registered in the awareness consciousness of the world. In 1926, I suspect your ideas were rooted in a chemist who got a Nobel Prize at that time. Is that roughly right?
Frederick Soddy. He absolutely
right.
Characterized all of this in the 20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much of that have we absorbed in the 80 years in between? I'm just saying this to put in context the question,
mm-hmm.
What is the size of the resistance that we have to consider when we're thinking about this realistically,
mm-hmm.
And what's the energy momentum behind it?
Right. Which raises a third piece, which is, if you really want to raise awareness, what's the best way to go about it? And so, yes, this story is going to be deeply challenging to a lot of status quo players. And that's always a tough sort of a road to hoe. But at this stage, you know, we have now some confirming evidence out there that our primary story is broken. You know, here's an interesting thing. My website for a long time tracked the inverse of the Dow. Dow had a bad day, my website had a good day, you know, and vice versa. And that started to decouple about 8 to 9 months ago, and it was really profound to me because I've tracked this very closely. And it's my own little one-off anecdote sort of social tracking thing. But I've discovered all over the place in my work that people have now figured out that there's this official story that doesn't feel right, and it's feeling worse and worse. And so when you know that something's wrong with your dominant story, that gives you an opportunity to make much deeper inroads with an alternative story, particularly if it has explanatory power and predictive power. If you can do those two things, you've got a much easier chance of getting there.
Yeah.
A tipping point of awareness does not happen when we hit 51%. According to Malcolm Gladwell's book, it happens when we get about 8 to 10%, but the right 8 to 10%. The question isn't how do we mass market this story to the whole wide world. The question is which 8 to 10% need to hear it, and how do we tell it?
Mm. I just don't think they're interested. If they're more into the next factor of EastEnders, then this story.
It's not, no, it's not, it's, no, because it's not my experience. So the way I frame this, when people, if somebody says, tell me in one sentence what you're trying to do, I say, I'm trying to create a world worth inheriting. I can find a lot of people are interested in that story. So after I gave the talk at the UN, I was invited to a party. It was on Park Avenue. It was way out of my pay grade. I'd never been to a penthouse on Park Avenue before. And I'd never been in a room with that many billionaires before. And they all cared about this story. And from a variety of different angles, but they cared. Because they said, something is really broken in this story. What do we do? Sometimes it's what do I do, so I can protect myself. But after you get through that, your next question is, okay, that's insufficient. What do we have to do more widely? I don't think I could have had that meeting or that story 2 years ago. So something has started to change in our story, and these tipping points happen really fast when they happen. You know, it's that truth all passes through three stages. You know, it's ignored, violently opposed, and then it becomes self-evident, right? I think we're getting into that. We're starting to see some opposition to this story, which is good because it means we're getting deeper into that second part. But eventually, this will just be self-evident, I believe. Mm. Saadi was early. We now have confirmatory evidence that's encroaching on us. That's not theoretical anymore. It's real. It's happening. We're going to be able to see this. And I truly believe that the people who have the right story out there, who can get a framework that makes sense for people, I think that story will win. Can we get there fast enough? I don't know.
I think that's the critical point, actually. Can we get there fast enough? Because people are listening. I mean, you said to me over lunch that yesterday you had a record attendance at the All-Party Parliamentary Committee on peak oil. These people would not have been there if they were not aware that there's something wrong and wanted to listen.
How many MPs?
I don't know.
No.
The one was supposed to be there, but yeah.
But, yeah. But I think it is happening, and more and more people are actually listening to this. And the other thing is we don't only take it at one level. It is not only the policymakers, is also all the other levels, including community level, which is where Sean is highly involved. And I think the story can also be repeated by David, who spoke to us last time. So I think we can pick up some of those points after the break. Or I know you've been dying to come in, so now it's your turn.
I quite like your idea of energy returns and energy investment, but the way I see it, these are, you said yourself, multidimensional problems. You know, any policy might have an impact on social, economic, international, wealth distribution, etc. So we can't really reduce it down to one dimension, such as the, you know, energy, etc. You know that you talk to these people, governments, UN, what kind of tools they use to look into potential possible futures?
Linear.
Not only linear, I think narrowed down into like environmental people looking into only the impact on the environment. Like you mentioned, there could be a solution, for example, nuclear solution that people are talking about, but that will obviously bring some environmental consequences. So how can people from different disciplines talk about these things, use same tools, and look into possible futures? I mean, maybe you can tell us if it is possible one day.
Well, yeah, I hope it's possible. To me, we really have to have some mechanism for holding all three in place at one time. I have noticed that, you know, when I see things that are just environmental sort of solutions, I can find an energy problem looking at that, just knowing what I know. And I see energy solutions that have environmental problems. So it feels like if we could just have some way of setting, I think just even guiding principles, even something at a higher level that just sort of says, here's the principles by which we're trying to approach these things and come up with intelligent responses. Because the day of really just burrowing down and not thinking about those cross linkages or externalities or feedbacks or whatever they happen to be, I think that that's something that we really have to get out of and away from. And so it feels to me like there's some things that we can do that are just really simple, though. That right now we can do some things that are just dead on easy that we don't have to think too hard about. I can't figure out why there isn't a solar hot water panel on every roof.
Absolutely.
It's just a no-brainer. From even just an economic standpoint,
yep.
It's just a no-brainer. You get payback in like 3 to 5 years,
yep.
Depending on where you live. But from an energy standpoint, it's just it's the best thing we could possibly do. We buy time, we conserve, we do all kinds of things. But we don't. And so I worry that we're going to have people say, we need something more. We need new understandings. We need new technologies. And we don't. I think we need to apply what we already know more rigorously and elegantly. In some way.
Yes, my favorite request is solar panels for air conditioning in the summer, which makes so much sense, and yet I wish somebody... Okay, there are an awful lot of people who do have questions, but tea has arrived, so I suggest we just take 15 minutes as a break and then start again at 4 o'clock, and I will take all your questions then. Okay, so there's tea and coffee.
Some sort of
table over there, actually.
Are you based at LSE?
Yes.